This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 5th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's lead article, Online Sellers Could Face Audits by North Carolina, by Lee Weisberger. From Raleigh. The specter of an audit of their books by North Carolina revenue officials hangs over more than 400 major out-of-state e-commerce retailers that have rejected the state's offer to forgive past non-payment of sales taxes in exchange for collecting the taxes going forward. At stake, by some estimates, for North Carolina is as much as $200 million in annual sales tax revenue that's not being collected. Since spring, officials in the North Carolina Department of Revenue have contacted 450 online sellers with a compromise offer. Past uncollected taxes, penalties, and fees would be forgiven in exchange for making collections going forward. Only 5%, or 24, of the companies agreed to the terms. The remaining sellers now face the possibility of being audited in a search for sales made to North Carolina purchasers. The 425 or so retailers won't automatically be audited, says DOR spokeswoman Beth Stevenson, who adds, quote, but they would be subject to audit just like any taxpayer in the state, end quote. DOR declines to release the identities of the companies that accepted the offer or those that had not responded by an August deadline. That is confidential taxpayer information, says Stevenson, who adds, there is the possibility that there are more companies that we did not originally identify. As a gauge of just how high the stakes are on the e-commerce front, DOR officials point to research by the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee. The center's Ryan Sowell says UT researchers estimate the amount of sales tax revenue not realized by each state due to failure to collect from online retailers. According to the most recent research, North Carolina stands to lose $161.8 million in 2010, $190 million in 2011, and $213.8 million in 2012. That's a total of $565.5 million. The state's unrealized revenue from 2007 through 2012 is estimated to be nearly $1 billion. The state is losing the most in the e-commerce sales dispute in California, which will lose an estimated $8.7 billion between 2007 and 2012, according to the UT study. Virginia would lose $946 million, South Carolina $569 million. Among the nation's largest online retailers is Seattle-based Amazon.com, which, with North Carolina revenue officials, have been in a prolonged struggle over the sales tax issue. The most recent blow came when a judge ruled against the state's request that Amazon turn over lists of North Carolina residents who purchased online and what they bought. Such a list would contain more than 50 million items purchased between August 2003 and February 2010, according to Amazon. Thus far, DOR has not published an estimate of the amount of back sales taxes it believes it is owed by Amazon. Neither has it said whether it is planning to take on any other larger national internet retailers. One way of short-circuiting what promises to be a potentially protracted tug-of-war as North Carolina and other states try to make up for huge budget gaps would be for the U.S. Congress to pass a law settling the e-commerce sales tax issues. The Washington, D.C.-based National Retail Federation is behind such a solution, pushing a bill that would require Internet retailers to collect the tax and remit it to the states. We think it's a matter of fairness, says NRF spokesman Craig Shearman, who expects such a bill to be introduced in the 2011 Congress. Not paying gives e-commerce merchants an unfair advantage over those who do. Still on the front page, NCSU to offer MBA via online, by James Gallagher. From Raleigh, aiming to grow its young MBA program, North Carolina State University is creating an online option patterned after successful internet rollouts at other universities, including Penn State and the University of Florida. The university's College of Management will begin accepting applications to the program in January, with the first class beginning in the fall of 2011. The first class will be intentionally small, about 30 to 40 students, but university officials expect it to grow substantially over the coming years, with as many as 1,000 students projected to enroll 5 years out. After the first cohort, we think it could be quite explosive, says Dean Ira Weiss, citing rapid growth at Penn State and Florida. Weiss says he's looking to draw interest from members of the military, stay-at-home parents who may want to return to the workforce, and others who, for one reason or another, are unable to venture to campus for evening or weekend courses. The ability to study online also removes geographic barriers, meaning students can learn from their homes across the state or even outside North Carolina. The college has been working to develop the program for quite some time, having received approvals from the university administrators, the Board of Trustees, and the UNC System Board of Governors. Steve Allen, the college's Associate Dean for Graduate Programs, says the decision to create the program now was driven primarily by technology. He says the point has been reached where the college can offer the same quality education online that it provides on campus. 5 years ago, I don't think we could say that, says Allen. The MBA program will join the many others that NCSU already offers online. The university's Distance Education and Learning Technology Applications, or DELTA, unit has been leading the charge in creating an online education technology as university leaders push for more online offerings. Because of the investment made by DELTA to buy technology needed to create the courses, the cost for creating new programs has been substantially reduced. Weiss estimates each online MBA class will cost about $25,000 to create. With 15 classes needed, the program total could reach $375,000. The cost would be 2 to 4 times that if the college also had to purchase the needed technology. Most of the funds are coming from university-supplied grants, says Weiss. As the online MBA program ramps up, the cost for creating additional courses will be covered by student tuition, which will be $30,600 for in-state students and $58,230 for out-of-state students. According to figures compiled by the Association to Advance Collegiate Schools of Business, 81 institutions in the U.S. offer hybrid or online MBAs. Jerry Trapnell, the association's executive vice president and chief accreditation officer, says such programs are excellent ways to tap new markets and new students and to extend the school's impact. Both UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University use online courses as part of their executive MBA programs, though the programs still maintain a classroom component. Susan Cates, Associate Dean for Executive Development at UNC's Keenan Flagler Business School, says the school is not averse to one day offering a completely online MBA, such as the one planned by NCSU. John Gallagher, Associate Dean for Executive MBA Programs at Duke's Fuqua School of Business, says Duke is not comfortable offering a completely online program. Gallagher says school leaders believe that students gain from their interaction in class, and it is impossible to provide the same experience online. Still on the front page at the bottom of the fold, Durham's West Brothers sold to Georgia Trucker by Chris Basden. From Durham, Georgia Trucking Company James Brown Contracting Incorporated has bought the four firms that comprise Durham-based West Brothers companies in a deal that will create a southeastern transportation powerhouse with more than 1,000 employees and in excess of 800 trucks. The triangle is losing the headquarters of a company that had $81 million in revenue last year. All of West Brothers' 6 Triangle locations and others in North Carolina and South Carolina will remain active. No employee cutbacks are anticipated, says Brown Trucking CEO Brian Kinsey. West Brothers has more than 500 full-time and part-time employees, with about half of them based in the Triangle. Brown has a similar number of employees. Kinsey says West Brothers will retain its name for the foreseeable future. Representatives of both companies declined to discuss the purchase price or the amount of revenue generated annually by West Brothers. Brown is headquartered in Lithonia, Georgia, and is owned by Navigation Capital Partners, an Atlanta-based private equity firm. West Brothers owners Craig West and Tommy West will not stay with the company. The brothers had run West Brothers since 1974, when they and a third brother bought out their parents, Floyd and Mary, who founded the firm as a package delivery company in 1946. 37 years is long enough, says Tommy West. Tommy, who is 62, and 59-year-old Craig are both retiring. Tommy West says he and Craig have been working toward a deal such as this for several years. Discussions with Brown began in April, and the deal closed in early October. Kinsey was attracted to the acquisition because while West Brothers was already in Brown's footprint, the two companies typically haul different types of cargo. "It's substantial customer diversification on our part," says Kinsey. Adds Tommy West, "the synergies of the deal were just compelling. They really were." West's trucking operations primarily are concentrated in North Carolina and South Carolina and are handled by a company called West Brothers Transportation Services. The Durham company hauls boxed paper, personal care products, pharmaceuticals, and construction and agricultural machinery. Brown, by contrast, focuses on paper and packaging, large appliances, building materials, and containers. Its trucking operations stretch across 9 southeastern states. In addition to the hauling operation, Brown also acquired freight brokerage service, West Brothers Transportation Solutions, LLC, truck leasing company Logistics Leasing, LLC, and warehousing services firm West Logistics, Incorporated. In general, the trucking business got hit hard during the recession. Kinsey says the industry is starting to improve and pricing is beginning to firm up. He's bullish on the future for a couple of reasons. First, manufacturers have been making fewer trucks over the past few years, and new U.S. Department of Transportation rules are tightening standards for drivers. Taken together, Kinsey says, the two developments will constrain capacity. That should give existing firms more business and more pricing power as the economy rebounds. The outlook for well-run trucking companies is very good, he says. Brandon Borgna, a spokesman for the American Trucking Association, says the industry is beginning to experience growth, though it is slow. Borgna says the vast majority of trucking firms have fewer than 20 trucks, making the Brown-West combination a formidable player, especially on a regional scale. Center to the front page of the Triangle Business Journal this week, color UNC board blue. Though it's the largest campus, NCSU has 4 Board of Governor members compared to Carolina's 11. By James Gallagher. From Chapel Hill, the UNC system's governing body, which represents all 16 of the state's universities, is dominated by board members who hold an undergraduate degree from UNC in Chapel Hill. 11 voting members of the UNC System Board of Governors, or UNC-BOG, holds undergraduate degrees from UNC Chapel Hill, with another 4 having earned law or graduate degrees there. NC State University grads hold the second highest number of seats, 4, followed by East Carolina University and Appalachian State University, which have 3 and 2 voting members, respectively. No other institution has more than 1 representative, and 7 institutions, including UNC Charlotte and UNC Wilmington, are not represented at all. Governors are elected by the General Assembly, which does not require that each institution be represented on the board. The applicable law stipulates only that those appointed not be employed by any state agency or be wed to an employee of a state agency. Joni Worthington, a spokeswoman for the system, says governors are elected to do what is best in the interest of all of higher public education and not represent the interest of any specific institution. Long known unofficially as the system's flagship university, a term that's sure to provoke a squabble with graduates of NCSU and Raleigh, the Chapel Hill campus has also long been perceived as having a favored status. The makeup of the BOG is bound to send a charge through such feelings. Board members, though, say there's no favoritism. "I think we make fair decisions based on need, and there may be some subtle benefit, but it's not significant at all," says Board Chairwoman Hannah Gage, adding that she is surprised at how little alma maters and political affiliations impact their decisions. Gage holds an undergraduate degree from UNCCH. Adds Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Brad Wilson, a non-voting emeritus board member, "We remind ourselves all the time, your loyalty is to the system as a whole, not at any one particular institution." And while on occasion the advocacy turns campus specific, it never becomes an us versus them discussion, he says. Wilson, whose undergraduate degree is from Appalachian State University in Boone, says board members are encouraged to visit various campuses so they are fully aware of each campus's strengths and needs. Senator Floyd McKissick, who sits on the North Carolina Senate's Education Higher Education Committee, says he wasn't aware of the large number of Chapel Hill grads on the board, but he isn't surprised. It's a very large institution. It is a flagship, he says. McKissick, who has an undergraduate degree from Clark University and a master's degree from UNCCH, says greater emphasis is placed on geographic distribution of governors than on campus representation. The governors represent 20 different North Carolina cities stretching across the state from Wilmington to Asheville. Still, 12 of the 32 voting members live in the Triangle area. UNC Wilmington Chancellor Rosemary DiPaolo says governors don't have to be alumni to support an institution. If you live in an area, you realize the importance of the university to that area, she says, pointing to Gage, the board's chairwoman, who graduated from UNC Chapel Hill but lives in Wilmington. Gage agrees, saying that where a board member lives often is a greater factor in decisions or advocacy than where one went to college. DiPaolo, who has announced her plans to retire, adds that when the governors realized several years ago that many of the state's smaller institutions were underfunded, they worked to correct that, though recent budget cuts erased those gains. Jane Shaw, executive director of the John William Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, says she doesn't necessarily see the distribution as a problem, but she does see it as reflective of UNC Chapel Hill's dominance within the state legislature. It has a lot of political clout, and its Political Action Committee has been able to achieve some things for the university it may not have been able to do otherwise, she says. As the educational background of members of the General Assembly becomes more diverse, many expect the composition of the Board of Governors to follow suit. As time passes, I think we'll have more and more graduates from other universities, just as we have had more members of the General Assembly who attended a university outside Chapel Hill and North Carolina State, says Gage. NCSU, with 33,000 students, is the system's largest, followed by UNCCH with an enrollment of 28,000. Inside the cover, RDU's Terminal No. 1, remake projected to cost $63 million, by Chris Basden, from Morrisville. Over the past few months, Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority officials have been coy about revealing the cost of the impending renovation of Terminal 1. But new airport documents show that RDU plans to spend about $63 million on the project, which it will pay for with internally generated funds. That's a much lower cost than the ongoing Terminal 2 project, a $570 million effort dedicated to rebuilding the entire facility, formerly known as Terminal C. The Terminal 1 job, by contrast, is a renovation that's akin to a facelift, albeit a relatively elaborate one. It'll be more than enough to pique the interest of local subcontractors. This is excellent timing in a market that is still sputtering because of a tough economy, says Dave Simpson, the building director for the Carolinas chapter of the Associated General Contractors of America. The Terminal 1 job will include renovating the ticket lobby, reworking the security checkpoint, making cosmetic changes internally and externally, and relocating Southwest Airlines. There will also be work on the roadway outside the terminal, and the baggage claim hall will be demolished. The road work, which includes a bypass around the terminal, will account for about one-third of the cost of the project. The renovation is part of a long-term strategy to move all the legacy carriers, such as American Airlines and Delta Airlines, into Terminal 2 and house low-cost carriers Southwest Airlines, JetBlue Airways, and AirTran Airways in a consolidated and refurbished Terminal 1. Southwest has announced plans to buy AirTran, which would mean those two operations eventually would combine if the deal closes. RDU has gone back and forth on cost estimates for the project as the economic tides have ebbed and flowed, from a high of $200 million down to $50 million or less. And recently, airport officials have declined to provide a solid number. The $63 million estimate was revealed in a bond document unrelated to the Terminal 1 renovation project. The purpose of that document is to detail the airport's financial picture for prospective investors. Joe Styris, RDU's Deputy Director of Finance, Business Administration, said in an interview that the $63 million figure could still move by a few million dollars. RDU plans to pay for the Terminal 1 renovation with a mixture of reserves and net revenue. RDU currently has about $130 million in reserve. Airport officials expect the RDU also will generate $20 million in net revenue, which is revenue minus operating expenses and debt service payments for the fiscal year that ends March 31st. Dave Powell, Director of Major Capital Improvements at the airport, says construction on the Terminal 1 project will begin in early 2012 calendar year, with completion about a year and a half after that. RDU recently announced that a joint venture between Balfour Beatty and D.H. Griffin would serve as a construction manager at risk on the project. That joint venture will hand out the subcontracts for the nuts and bolts of the renovation. Those contracts likely will be awarded early in the first quarter of 2012. Raleigh-based architectural firm Pierce Brinkley Cease and Lee have been working with RDU to develop the scope of the project. Powell says airport staff plans to ask the authority board to approve a contract with Pierce Brinkley for design services at the November board meeting. In addition to the design and construction contracts, the airport will hand out several technology contracts. Those will be awarded 6 to 9 months after the construction subcontracting work, Powell says. The second phase of the Terminal 2 project is on pace to open in January 2011. RDU primarily has financed that project using bonds, but also plans to use some of its reserves. Even so, Styris says he doesn't expect the airport to let its level of reserve slip much below the $100 million mark. Next article, feeling foreclosure pain. Triangle properties seized are 1.4% of total market, 7 times the normal. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Durham. As the number of bank-owned properties in the Triangle continues to swell, real estate agents like Jim Fischetti of Durham are educating themselves on the legalese of short sales, foreclosures, and defaults. I spent 25 years in the real estate industry and avoided foreclosures, but now you don't have a choice, says Fischetti, a partner with the Keller Williams Realty Mitchell Fischetti Group in Durham. It's the market of the moment. The Triangle now is home to more than 9,300 properties that are owned by banks or other financial institutions, or about 1.4% of the market's parcel inventory, according to a study by SiteTech Systems, a real estate research and consulting firm based in Garden City, South Carolina. Known as real estate owned, or REO, properties, the highest concentration in North Carolina are in Durham, Franklin, Mecklenburg, Brunswick, and Nash counties, according to SiteTech's research. Counties in the northeastern section of the state maintain the lowest level of REO concentration. Most properties classified as REO have gone through the foreclosure process after an owner defaulted on a loan or other financial obligation. The areas of the state which experience a high level of growth, price appreciation, and speculative lending are experiencing the highest concentration of REOs, says Todd Woodard, president of SiteTech. In the Triangle, REO concentration is in the northern and western sections of the region, which experienced a lot of speculative growth in new development and construction lending in the 5 years leading up to the housing downturn and recession in 2008. As the economy turned and financing began to tighten, the demand for lots and new homes in this area diminished, Woodard explains. We anticipate another challenging year in 2011 before the housing market stabilizes. The SiteTech study evaluated every residential and commercial property parcel by zip code in the Triangle region and categorized each as extreme, high, elevated, moderate, or low based on the percentage of REO parcels as of October 26th. Among the 84 zip codes tracked in the Triangle, 3 were classified as extreme, 9 were classified as high, 34 were classified as elevated, 17 were classified as moderate, and 21 were classified as low, with fewer than 0.5% of REO properties. Durham zip codes 27713, 27701, 27703, and 27704 have the highest REO concentrations in the region. Raleigh's 27605, 27608, and Chapel Hill's 27516 zip codes had the smallest concentration of REO properties. As a whole, the Triangle REO market would rank as elevated, with an REO percentage of 1.4%. Fischetti says that is about 7 times higher than the market's REO average of around 0.12% prior to the recession. And until we absorb the at-risk inventory that is either REO or in default, you are not going to have a stabilized market, he says. Complicating matters are concerns that Home Loan Services, working for the Bank of America Corporation, Wells Fargo & Company, and J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, undertook deceptive practices involving foreclosure documents. Robert Briere, an REO specialist with Referral Realty Group in Raleigh, says the banks have slowed their agent assignments and auction sales of REO properties in recent weeks, and that has tempered sales activity. We need to get that back on track because REOs are killing the value of properties. Breer estimates that an REO home property sells for about 10 or 12% below its value, which can drag down the value of non-foreclosed homes around it. Everything is on hold right now. Next up, BB&T leads in foreclosed sites, by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, among financial institutions, Winston-Salem-based BB&T was holding the most real estate-owned properties, banking jargon for foreclosed homes and land parcels, in the Triangle as of late October. The region's number two bank in terms of market share held 649 single and multifamily homes, plus vacant parcels, according to an inventory of more than 10,000 properties prepared by Garden City, South Carolina-based SiteTech Systems, a real estate research firm. BB&T spokeswoman Mary Tolbert said she couldn't comment on the data without seeing the report and understanding the methodology. The second largest owner of foreclosed properties, in this case almost exclusively single-family homes, was the Federal National Mortgage Association, known as Fannie Mae. The mortgage giant, now under the thumb of the federal government, held 374 foreclosed properties throughout the region that comprises Durham, Orange, and Wake counties. The difficulty with the Fannie Mae number, according to SiteTech Systems researcher Patrick Rhodes, is that it is impossible to tell whether the foreclosed holdings under the agency's name came off defaulted mortgage loans initiated by Fannie Mae or were those written by other lenders and later sold to Fannie Mae. In either case, the agency is now listed as the owner. Third on the Triangle list was Wells Fargo Wachovia with 303 property listings in both homes and vacant lots. The Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, better known as Freddie Mac, was fourth with 237. HUD, the Federal Housing Agency, was fifth with 190, according to the survey. Banks, both large and regional, round out the list of the top dozen holders of foreclosed property in the Triangle. As the banks work through the troubled properties, the number in the raw property inventory will change. And though the timing may vary from state to state, it takes a bank, on average, between 90 and 100 days to move a house through foreclosure, from loan delinquency through assumption of property, says bank consultant Don Coker. In North Carolina, the average is about 110 days, he says. Rolling on to the next article, Cary dealer gets right to sell spiffy $300,000 spiker, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Cary, a dealership in Cary is only one of only 17 in the nation that will carry the spiker, a $200,000-plus roadster made by a Dutch company that produces only about 50 of the autos each year. Spikers, which are made only when orders are received, will be sold by the Hendrick Cadillac Saab dealership. Engineered to aircraft-type standards, a base model spiker starts at around $209,000, and most models, once customized, average around $300,000. Owners can follow the assembly of their spiker by means of webcams at the factory. The import is so rare that not a single spiker is registered in the North Carolina Department of Motor Vehicles database, confirms DMV spokeswoman Marge Howell. Spyker will replace the discontinued Hummer brand at Hendrick's Carry Auto Mall. Hendrick spokeswoman Monica Weymouth confirms that the dealership is selling Spyker and Carry, but no one at the dealership returned calls for further comment. Luxury brand cars increasingly have been finding their way to North Carolina. Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Aston Martin, Lamborghini, Ferrari, and Maserati have forged dealer partnerships in the state over the past few years. Lamborghini, an Italian-made car known for its speed, is sold at 27 dealerships in the U.S., including the Lamborghini Carolinas franchise in Greensboro that opened about 4 years ago. Jesse Neely, the after-sales director for Lamborghini Carolinas, says the region has become a hotspot for exotic cars. A lot of our customers are from the Raleigh area, but most of our market is over the internet or over the phone from out of state, he says. Neely says annual sales of Lamborghinis, which start at $230,000 at his dealership, are in the high teens. Robert Glaser, president of the North Carolina Automobile Dealers Association, says brands are recognizing that the state's auto sales industry is recovering from the economic downturn faster than many other states. Sales are up 15% over last year, Glaser says. Sales are still down 30% to the average, but dealers appreciate that they are not in areas like upstate Michigan that are still in the economic doldrums. Spyker Cars unveiled its first Spyker C8 at the Birmingham Motor Show in 2000 and began offering sales in the U.S. in 2005. It gained international recognition in February when it bought the Saab brand from General Motors for $400 million and rescued the Swedish premium brand from the chopping block. Saab had more than 200 dealerships in the U.S. and produced about 90,000 cars in 2008 before Spyker acquired it in February. Production was cut back to about 35,000 units in 2010, but Spyker executives have projected Saab will sell about 80,000 cars in 2011. The company intends to market the Saab brand heavily in Russia and China. Spyker is counting on the Saab brand to revive its sagging financials. The company reported a third-quarter loss of 50 million euros in October, compared to the loss of 3.4 million euros in the same quarter in 2009. Garmin's new office in Cary shifted to different mission, by Frank Van Leeuwen. From Cary. Less than a year after announcing a new North Carolina office that would employ R&D workers developing smartphones, satellite navigation device maker Garmin is changing course with its triangle plans as the company drops out all of the smartphone business altogether. Workers hired in Cary to design smartphones will be shifted to other projects, some of them new initiatives for the company, says Garmin spokesman Ted Gardner, explaining that the company is redeploying our mobile phone engineers to other projects within Garmin. Gartner says the company isn't ready to discuss those new initiatives. The Cary site currently employs about 30. Olenthi, Kansas-based Garmin, announced in January plans to hire 40 workers in North Carolina to support the company's mobile handset efforts. The expansion followed a 2009 partnership with Taiwan-based AsusTech Computer to jointly develop and market a smartphone that would incorporate Garmin's navigation technology. But disappointing sales of the jointly marketed Garmin Asus smartphones led Garmin to announce in October that it would get out of the smartphone business, choosing instead to focus on developing navigation applications. That left the future of the Cary operation cloudy. Chris Kozarski, the Cary-based director of handset engineering for Garmin, referred questions about the North Carolina office to the company's corporate offices. Sandy Jordan, vice president of economic development for the Cary Chamber of Commerce, said Garmin did not speak specifically to him about the job skills the company was looking for, but the company's website still has job listings that were posted in January seeking software developers and application developers for jobs in North Carolina. Garmin, which sells navigation devices for marine and aviation uses, groups its mobile phone business with its automotive segment. Third quarter revenue for that segment, the company's largest, was $442 million, down by 19% compared to third quarter last year. Mobile phones accounted for about $25 million of that revenue, says CFO Kevin Rockman. Cliff Pemble, Garmin's president and COO, told analysts during a November 3rd conference call to discuss earnings that while the company foresaw the explosion of the new smartphone market, it did not expect consumers to solidly embrace certain iconic brands. Garmin Asus phones, smartphones, were supposed to play a key role in Garmin's future. But Dougherty & Company analyst Jeff Evanson writes in a recent report that the company faced tough competition from Nokia, HTC, and Apple. Of all those competing brands, Evanson wrote, all have greater distribution and brand power in this category. Following that article, with $17 million in venture capital, Overture is in overdrive to storm the market. Morrisville company faces still competition in building technology to speed data transfers. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Morrisville. When a securities trade is executed, seconds can mean the difference between making or losing millions. Morrisville-based telecommunications vendor Overture Networks is betting that companies such as brokerages and data centers will want new equipment that allows for data transmission without even split-second delays, and has begun aiming its marketing at them. The move is part of the company's rapid R&D work that's being paid for largely by a $17 million fourth round of venture funding that closed in April. The company is backed by Morgan Thaler Ventures, InterSouth Partners, TDF Fund, Tenya Capital, and Questmark Partners. Overture President David Steelen says that by scaling up operations and ramping up development work, the company is able to reach the market faster and get an edge over competitors. Michael Howard, principal analyst for carrier and data center networks at Infinetics Research, says Overture, for now, does have an edge over competitive offerings with equipment that is faster and more flexible. But he notes that telecom vendors are always leapfrogging each other. Overture, which is helmed by CEO Jeff Reedy, has plenty of competitors, some of them much larger and with broader offerings. Huntsville, Alabama-based Adtran also provides equipment to carriers and enterprise customers, though it doesn't offer a sales breakdown of its $484 million in 2009 sales. Occam Networks, based in Santa Barbara, California, generated $84 million in 2009. Steelen won't disclose any revenue figures for privately held Overture. Howard says there hasn't been as much merger and acquisition activity, and startups such as Overture continue to develop new equipment for the space. Overture makes gear for what's called carrier Ethernet. Fiber optic networks have the capacity to move massive amounts of data at fast speeds, but data runs into a bottleneck at the network's edge, where the last few miles to an office building are typically served by older, slower copper wires. Overture sells carriers who, in turn, make that equipment available to their business customers. The equipment boosts the capacity and speeds of the copper infrastructure. Howard says that the biggest driver for carrier Ethernet is the growing customer need for bandwidth. Spending on carrier Ethernet reached $21.6 billion in 2009 and is expected to project to reach $32 billion in 2014. In the niche where Overture plays, making Ethernet access devices, Howard says the market will be $754 million this year and will more than double to $1.9 billion by 2014. Craig Clausen, executive vice president at consulting firm New Paradigm Resources Group, says brokerages make sense as target customers because many of them use automated trade systems that trade based on algorithms. Trades can be held up by even split-second delays in transmitting data. Data centers also are looking to use carrier Ethernet technology, particularly facilities in remote locations not well served by fiber. Clausen says companies that house data and applications at off-site facilities will still want access to that data just as quickly as if it were in-house. If you have to wait 3 seconds, that seems like an eternity, Clausen says. Overture has more than 250 customers worldwide, Steelen says. The company now employs more than 130, up from 110 in April, and continues to hire for technical positions as well as for jobs in sales and marketing. Next up, Investing Veterans Launch Unique Private Equity Firm by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, the father-son team of William M. Bill Moore and his son Merritt Moore are laying the groundwork for a new private equity investing group that will debut in early 2011. Lookout Capital, set up as a limited liability company with the office of North Carolina Secretary of State in April, recently raised a modest $500,000 in an initial stock offering, according to a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The firm has established a website where the partners explain that the firm is set up as an invitation-only group of investors who pay an annual fee for the right to invest on a deal-by-deal basis. "We are an industry agnostic," the site explains. Investment targets will be North Carolina companies with annual revenues between $1 million and $5 million that are operating at or near break-even to profitable and that have recurring revenue or repeat customers. As a condition of investment for each portfolio company, a lookout principal or close associate either serves in a consulting role or joins the management team for up to a year and potentially longer when appropriate, the site also explains. "We also serve on the board of directors of all of our portfolio companies." Attempts to reach Lookout Capital managing partner Merritt Moore produced an email response that described the group's investing model as very unique to this geographic area. "We are planning a public launch in January, when our situation will be more fully informed and a better story can be told. And we'll be happy to talk to you at that time," the statement says. "Until then, we prefer to refrain from public comment." Educated at UNC Chapel Hill, including an MBA, Merritt Moore began his career with Wachovia, but also served stints with Chapel Hill-based Franklin Street Partners, the Microelectronics Center of North Carolina, and most recently, NC IDEA, which makes grants to high-tech startups. His father, Bill Moore, founded and 25 years later sold Trident Financial, a boutique investment banking firm. He was briefly CEO of MCNC and serves on the board at Franklin Street Partners. He currently is a professor of finance at UNC's Keenan Flagler Business School, where he teaches investment banking. "It's a very good pairing," says Ted Zoller, executive director of the UNC Business School's Center for Entrepreneurial Studies. "They are the kind of guys that make things happen. They will be investing in an early stage niche that has been underserved in the past." "I'd certainly agree with that," says Ed Turekian, managing director for a Durham-based Argentine capital management company, which provides financial management services to high net worth clients and institutions, but also engages in private equity investing. "Regional banks had filled that place, but I think they've been pulling back," says Turekian. "That $1 million to $5 million niche is open money, and a lot of companies are looking for it." Next up, RBC solid with Canes despite ACC pullout, by Chris Basden. From Greensboro, despite pulling the plug on their company's role as the official bank of Atlantic Coast Conference, officials with RBC Bank say they remain committed to sports marketing and to their relationship with the RBC Center in particular. When RBC Bank opted not to renew the ACC agreement, BB&T moved in and took over as banking partner with the league. RBC Bank spokeswoman Dorsey Landis says the bank enjoyed a successful seven-year partnership with the ACC. But she says that over the past few years, the bank's territories have expanded to include markets in Alabama and Florida, where the ACC isn't as relevant as it is in North Carolina. "We enjoyed the ACC partnership, but to have our brand properties best serve all of our markets throughout our southeastern footprint, as well as better align with our global RBC brand strategy, we chose not to renew our contract with the ACC," she writes in an email. RBC Bank has 12 years left on its naming rights agreement with the RBC Center, which is home to the Carolina Hurricanes and the NC State University men's basketball team. The 20-year deal, in which RBC Bank pays $4 million annually, started in 2002 and will expire on August 31, 2022. Landis says the bank has strengthened its relationship with the arena and the Hurricanes over the years by developing activities and initiatives in support of the team's programs. That includes supporting youth hockey programs, donating tickets for arena events to nonprofits and military families. We do remain committed to our naming rights partnership with the RBC Center, Landis says in a phone conversation. Asked about the possibility of renewing the deal when the time comes, Landis says she's not in a position to talk about 12 years from now. Arena officials don't seem worried. It's our understanding that they're very pleased with the naming rights deal, says Dave Olson, general manager of the arena. Tom McCormick, the chairman of the Centennial Authority, which serves as the arena's landlord, points out that the bank's parent company is based in Canada. Hockey is a huge sport in Canada. I'm sure this is something they're more comfortable with, McCormick says. Hill Caro of Carey consulting firm Sports and Properties Incorporated says naming rights deals in the industry have taken longer to get done over the past couple of years due to the economic downturn. Though he says the situation has improved this year, there's been plenty of belt tightening with potential sponsors who have been worried about the appearance of striking a gaudy deal in a difficult economic environment. But that's not a problem for the Hurricanes. They're fortunate to have a place in a long-term deal that goes out to 2022, says Caro. It's a very good deal, I think, for both parties. Caro has done consulting work for RBC regarding the naming rights pact with the arena in the past. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Nonprofit links students with work. From Todd Cohen. 2 years ago, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina was looking for bilingual customer service representatives. With nonprofit Futures for Kids acting as go-between, teachers at Sanderson High School in Raleigh identified students whose personalized portfolios they had created at the nonprofit's website suggested they might be interested in those kinds of jobs. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, which offers tuition reimbursement for employees, hired two of those students after they graduated from Sanderson. Businesses have not had a way to communicate directly with students interested in specific careers, says Susan Milliken, Executive Director of Futures for Kids. Founded in 2001, the Raleigh-based statewide nonprofit helps students identify their career interests and learn what it takes to pursue those careers, and also connects them with mentors and employers. The group is working this school year with more than 65,000 students in 59 school systems, representing well over half the students in just over half the 115 school systems in the state, including most of the largest systems. Operating with four employees and an annual budget of $370,000, the nonprofit has enlisted roughly 400 corporate partners and more than 800 volunteer career coaches. It has reduced expenses by licensing an online system from Toronto-based Career Cruising in a move that allows the nonprofit to focus its attention on training school counselors and career development coordinators to use its site in working with students and on recruiting employers and career coaches. Through their teachers, students use the Futures for Kids web-based software to complete forms that assess their learning style and interests, get tips on how to use their learning style to their best advantage, and begin exploring careers for which they seem suited. The software provides students with information about salaries, working conditions, the outlook for jobs, and the education they need to get those jobs, with links to colleges and universities in North Carolina and throughout the U.S. that offer those kinds of programs. The system also gives educators information about their students' learning style so they can adjust their classroom activities to better meet the students' needs. Students can also use the career profiles the software creates to connect with companies in the industries for which they seem suited, and with career coaches, with Futures for Kids acting as intermediary in both cases. Now the nonprofit is developing a program that will let students shadow workers, tour companies, and hear classroom speakers. Last spring, for example, Piedmont Natural Gas hosted 11 high school students in Robeson County. They were enrolled in construction classes and shown the company's welding and pipe fitting shops and drafting rooms. Piedmont says they have pipelines for their engineers, but they don't have specific strategy to generate any interest for those trade positions, says Rebecca Cooper, communications manager for Futures for Kids. Milliken says the group is focusing on recruiting career coaches and employers. This is an easy way, she says, to mentor students in middle and high school, show students the relevance of their education, and develop a workforce for employers. And now, Money Matters. Giving Lost Golf Balls New Life by Dale Gibson. From Pinehurst. Back when Sam Snowden moved to the Sand Hills area of North Carolina and began playing golf, he learned how expensive the hobby could be, especially for newbies learning the game. It wasn't the green fees that were killing me in the learning curve, he says. It was the golf balls. As in the cost of golf balls yanked into deep woods, impossible thickets, or ponds. With the price of a sleeve, three balls, ranging from as little as $3 to as much as $15, losing balls can be an expensive proposition. Snowden, now 52, looked for a way to cut his cost and found it at a Pinehurst golf course where an enterprising fellow was selling balls fished out of golf course ponds. A graduate of St. Andrews College in Laurinburg with a degree in business management who has taught himself the science of internet commerce, Snowden deduced that the used golf ball peddler was onto something good. Already an accomplished diver, Snowden decided to combine his affinity for golf with his growing knowledge of how to sell on the Internet to launch in 1997 an Internet site where golfers could buy used golf balls retrieved from the bottom of golf course ponds. Recovered Balls International grew to 5 e-commerce sites selling used golf balls. Earlier this year, Snowden sold his ownership stake and folded his company into a Stuart, Florida company called Nitro Golf. He is now the executive director of e-commerce for Nitro. The combined companies today dispatch fleets of divers to more than 500 golf courses in the Southeast alone. The divers, most of them using mesh laundry bags, dig more than 25 million lost golf balls out of the muck of the ponds. Balls that are cleaned, graded, and sold again as used. For golfers who don't mind using a second-hand ball, the savings can be significant. For example, the Titleist Pro V1 ball, the ball used by Tiger Woods and preferred by many accomplished amateur golfers, cost around $50 for a dozen. At www.usedgolfballdeals.com, the highest quality Pro V1 reconditioned dozen is $24. Keeping up with so many ponds at so many golf courses is no easy task. If the divers return too soon, not enough balls will have been driven into the drink to make the trip worthwhile. To keep up with it all, the company has developed a software that can calculate when it's time to return to a certain pond. Among courses worked by Snowden's divers is National Golf Club in Pinehurst. Sam is a very efficient worker, and his company is efficient and professional, says Tom Parsons, director of golf at National. Snowden didn't want to discuss his company's rates, but the golf ball divers generally are paid 7 cents to 9 cents for each ball they bring up. Arrangements with courses can vary. Some courses are paid an amount per ball fished from their ponds, generally from 5 cents to 12 cents. Others prefer to take their payout in the form of driving range balls they have to purchase each year. Some divers stay busy diving for balls year-round, and Snowden says the best ones can bring in a six-figure annual income. It's hard, nasty work. Consider waters with snakes, gators, or crocodiles. But he says it's rewarding. I enjoy getting balls out of the water more than hitting them, Snowden says, in what can be best described as a Capote-esque southern drawl. That's a good thing, because in the end, many are headed back into the water. And now an article about family business, by James Lee. Diligent research uncovers mysteries of family businesses. This column's research department, staffed by a crack team of MBA students who got into business school because of their uncanny ability to find lost socks in the washer, has come up with this short list of family business mysteries. The mystery of the unfiltered gene pool. This oft-repeated puzzler features the family-owned company that becomes a haven for every family member who wants to work. Wants a job. Wants an income. Although the hiring criteria for non-family employees are probably quite clear, the company has no threshold requirements for family members joining the business. There are several mysterious things about this kind of company. One is why an otherwise heads-up business operation won't get more businesslike in dealing with the hiring and firing of family members. When a family company declares that every relative who's able to get off the bus at the right stop is assured of a regular paycheck, it quickly becomes less of a business and more of a welfare fund. This kind of open-door policy has siphoned the life out of more than one good company. So the ultimate mystery is how any family business that runs like this stays afloat. The mystery of the purloined prerequisite. Smart companies treat prerequisites, or perks, as part of total compensation, amenities to be earned by performance, rank, or longevity. Being promoted to a vice presidency, for example, or producing a 20% leap in sales might carry with it the use of a company car, weekends at the corporate beach house, or other goodies. Here's the mystery. Why do some family-owned businesses provide perks simply on the grounds of family membership? What happens to the value of performance incentives if they're passed out to worker ants and happy grasshoppers alike? The mystery of the out-of-control ownership. My friend Max distributed stock in his retail clothing company to his kids, his sisters, their kids, and their kids' kids. But he didn't distribute all the stock, and he didn't distribute voting stock. With a little forethought and some good advice from his attorney, Max ensured the long-term interest of his family in the stability and success of the company. But he didn't give away the store, and he didn't turn loose of management control. Smart guy. So it's truly mystifying that a more family-owned businesses don't do likewise. To many senior family business owners, hold on everything possible shred of ownership, making other family members jealous, suspicious, and ready for rebellion. Others toss around stock, undifferentiated and in many cases votable, like petals at the Rose Bowl parade. The result? As those companies grow and become more profitable, their owners come face to face with a lot of unnecessary problems in running them, defending them, against family members no less, and perpetuating them as family businesses. Handing out jobs, perks, and even company ownership like candy canes at Christmas is not particularly visionary behavior. It can keep a family business from achieving its potential. My Turn by Dale Gibson. As usual, a season to remember. I was rooting hard for the Texas Rangers to win the World Series and for Raleigh's Josh Hamilton to lead the way, so I'm disappointed. Still, this year's baseball playoffs were superb. The five games of the World Series also were excellent, not because the games were competitive, the Giants pretty much won in a landslide, but because of the outstanding pitching displayed, really, by both teams. San Francisco ended up winning the Battle of the Mound, proving once again that great pitching will trump every great hitting every time. While the Rangers will remain in my team as long as Hamilton plays in Dallas, I now have a new favorite pitcher. Besides having great stuff and outstanding control, Tim Lyceum is a joy to watch as he spins his magic. He's a lithe little guy with his long locks and contorted facial features, a baby face really, who can mow down the best and biggest at the plate. Born in Bellevue, Washington, and standing 5'11 and weighing maybe 175 pounds, Lyceum was viewed as one of the best pitchers in baseball before the playoffs. Now having won the clinching game of the World Series in commanding fashion, and showing off another sense of fashion with his bow tie, he's bound to have millions of dollars bouncing his way in terms of endorsements. Good for him. Seems like a decent guy to me, the kind you don't mind your kids looking up to. Each year in October, the seasons of all the major professional sports overlap. Baseball is ending its season, and football and basketball and hockey are getting into gear. I have never been a fan of professional basketball because I see very little in the way of strategy going on. I've come to love hockey since the Hurricanes set up shop here. As for NFL football, I am and have been ambivalent about the sport, but my like for it is beginning to fade. Here's why. The linemen, both on offense and defense, are so big and so strong that the game has become more like a sumo wrestling match than a true sporting event. Considering all the numbers and whatever happens with the rest of the games, it's no wonder that professional athletes are pulling down major dollars. So take your choice. Mine's baseball. We've run out of time today for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.